Elizabeth Elliot says, Hollywood's notion of love is millions of miles from the slightest comprehension of what the love of God is all about. Welcome to Gateway to Joy, a ministry of Elizabeth Elliot, author of Quest for Love and Love Has a Price Tag, helping you lovingly put God's principles into action in your daily life. Here's Elizabeth.
You are loved with an everlasting love. That's what the Bible says. And underneath are the everlasting arms. This is your friend, Elizabeth Elliot, talking again this week about an amazing little woman from London. She was just a parlor maid. Her name was Gladys Aylward. I told you the story of how I heard her speak at Prairie Bible Institute in Alberta, Canada. And I was wondering if she was going to be able to make herself heard, because back in those days, they didn't happen to have a sound system, amplification. And I saw this tiny little lady up there on the platform. They had to put a box for her to stand on so that she could be seen over the podium. Well, I need not have worried about her voice, because the very first thing she said when she stood up was, "I should like to read just one verse. And Jehovah God spoke to Abram, and he said, 'Get out.' And Abram got out." Well, she jolly well got out, too, when God told her to go to China. Gladys Aylward packed her two suitcases. I think I said one last week, but that's not true. She actually did have two whole suitcases. A kettle and a saucepan were tied to the handle of one of them. And she got out. And she went to work in China with a woman named Jeannie Lawson, 74-year-old widow who was absolutely a no-nonsense, very courageous old lady. And their time together was rather short because Jeannie Lawson died. Gladys had declined to go for a walk with Jeannie one day because she wanted to study. And Jeannie was put out with her, and there was a rift between them. Well, Gladys went to another mission station for a short visit to let Jeannie cool off, and Jeannie followed after her, but was injured on the way and died not very long after that. Gladys developed a close friendship with the Mandarin, who had absolutely no idea how to treat her because there was no protocol for foreigners. A Mandarin knew exactly how to treat his subjects, but he was not sure how to treat this very strong-minded little lady from England. And one day he asked her to pull down the pagoda of the scorpion, and a huge feast followed. When the Mandarin's feast was held, Gladys, to her surprise, found that although, as usual, she was the only woman present, that had been her privilege for many years, on this occasion, she was sitting beside the Mandarin in the seat of honor at his right hand. This had never happened before. All the important personages of Yangcheng were present: the governor of the prison, two wealthy merchants, several officials, about a dozen in all. The meal was simple, unlike the sumptuous feasts she had enjoyed in early years and which had lasted for hours. Toward the close, the Mandarin stood up and made his speech. He recalled how Ai Weide, which was Gladys's name in Chinese, had first come to Yangcheng, how she had worked for them, what she had done for the poor and the sick and the imprisoned, the new faith called Christianity, which she had brought with her, and which he had discussed with her many times. Gladys was puzzled by his references. He sounded so much like the chairman of a local committee back in England that she wondered if he were going to present her with an illuminated address or a silver teapot. But after speaking for some minutes, he turned very gravely toward her and said seriously, "I would like to become a Christian." Around the table arose a murmur of astonishment. Gladys was so astounded that she could hardly speak. The guests nodded and smiled, and she knew that she was expected to reply. She got up and stuttered her surprise, her appreciation, and her thanks. The Mandarin saw her confusion and helped her out. "We'll talk of all details later, Ai Weide," he said. She sat down, realizing that she had made her most important convert since coming to China. One day, a messenger came running. The Japanese had entered the Christian mission of Qin Shui. There were 200 refugees at the mission. Please come and help. Gladys already had a huge collection of slave girls, murderers, and convicts, and the Mandarin had not known whether to release them or to execute them. And she, not surprisingly, volunteered to take responsibility for all these slave girls, murderers, and convicts. The city had been bombed. Therefore, they could expect the enemy to follow up the bombing. Everyone must leave the town not later than the first light the next day. As she listened to the voice of this tall, thin figure in his Mandarin robes, standing on the gray stone steps of the temple with pagoda roofs and the city wall framed behind him, and the hot blue sky and the mountains beyond, Gladys realized how often, through the centuries, such a scene must have been enacted. The invaders invariably came from the north, bringing blood and death and destruction. The people fled to the mountains, then crept back again when the enemy had gone, to bury their dead and rebuild their homes. Gladys then realized that God had fashioned them well, these mountain people. For her part, she would never abandon them, no matter what happened. In a letter sent home that year to her mother, on a grubby scrap of paper, she wrote, "Do not wish me out of this, or in any way seek to get me out, for I will not be got out while this trial is on. These are my people. God has given them to me, and I will live or die with them for him and his glory." The news that the small woman who possessed a god with magical powers of protection lived in the village had reached many people, and a constant stream of supplicants was the result. On the afternoon that the Japanese came, she was tending one of the sick women in an upstairs room. Even before her door banged open, she heard Wan Yu's shrill scream, "They're here! They're here!" Quickly, she ran downstairs and across to the hole in the courtyard wall. She peered out. Theirs was the first house in the village. Only a small temple about 50 yards away lay farther down the valley. She could hear the priests blowing horns, banging drums, and offering up obeisances which were supposed to drive the Japanese away. As she watched, she saw a number of khaki-clad figures advance through the terraces and group near the temple. They talked among themselves. Some of them went toward the temple. Others started toward Wan Yu's house. Inevitably, the next place they entered would be this courtyard, unless she did something to prevent it. "Hide yourselves quickly," she shouted to Wan Yu. "I'll try to keep them out." She ran to the front gate. She did not know what to do. She only knew she must stop them, even to the extent of going out and fighting them with her bare hands. If she appeared by herself, perhaps the sight of a foreign devil in such an unusual place might occupy their attention for a time. Perhaps they would even forget about the others. The outside door was solid, the latch of heavy iron, and as she got to it, her courage ebbed away. She leaned against the door, turning so that her back was braced against it for support. Her clenched hand went to her heart to try to stop its pounding. For perhaps 10 seconds she stood there, reaching with desperate mental agony for strength. Then, into the confusion of her mind, with the clarity of an articulate voice, came this phrase, "My grace is sufficient for thee, because my strength is made perfect in weakness." She stood straight, and the feeling of panic seeped away. Then she turned, pressed down the latch, swung open the heavy door, and stepped out into the bright sunshine, abruptly aware of Wan Yu's piping voice from the balcony behind her. "Ah Wei De, they've turned back. They're going down the valley. They're going away." She felt the sunshine warm on her face. When she went inside, the old women were crying in relief. At another mission, she was knocked unconscious by a Japanese rifle butt. Colonel Lin An of Generalissimo Chiang Kai-shek's intelligence service asked for help. "Please take care," he said. "Please take care." She was a week out in the mountain country, and when she got back, Lin-An was waiting for her. His relief was quite plain. "But I've made these journeys 100 times, protested Gladys. "There's really nothing to worry about at all." That a young colonel of Chiang Kai-shek's intelligence should be bothered about someone as inconsequential as Gladys amused her. It was also very flattering. His visits became more and more regular. They became good friends. They were the same age. Both had eager, inquisitive minds. In the evening, they would often walk together through the narrow streets of Tse Cho, past the dark bazaars hung with Chinese lanterns, past the fortune tellers and the storytellers, the food stalls and the silk merchant shops, among the gossiping and laughing soldiers. He opened for her a new window on a country she had thought she already knew intimately, but which now she realized she knew hardly at all. Each time they met in the weeks that followed, the immense gulf between their separate worlds grew narrower. His voice fascinated her. One evening, as he rose to leave, he bowed as usual, but his eyes in the soft lamplight held an awareness and intimacy that she had not seen before. She said good night abruptly. Was she attractive, she wondered? Was there still in her face and body the indefinable mystery that draws a man to a woman? And we will continue with our Gladys Aylward story tomorrow.
You've been listening to Gateway to Joy with Elizabeth Elliot, author of over 20 books, including Discipline, The Glad Surrender, and No Graven Image. Join us next time for more encouragement and challenge from Elizabeth Elliot. This has been a production of the Bible Broadcasting Network.